I mean, you know what I'm going to say here. The financial data is not good. Let's keep working on the way forward. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, May 15th, and it's good to have you with us. It is indeed, as I mentioned, the end of another week of absolutely brutal financial data that, of course, translates into real pain for people and businesses of almost all sizes. So with the table set, let's chew on some of this news with our weekly panel. Heather Long is with The Washington Post. Kate Davidson is at The Wall Street Journal. Hey, you too.
Hey, Polly.
We obviously have terrible retail data, terrible manufacturing data. Some of that's coming up a little later in the show. But I want to start with the Fed and this kind of almost PR tour that Jerome Powell has been on. He's basically saying, you know, listen, I did my part. The markets are stable. And now, Congress, the ball is in your court. We are, as we are speaking, awaiting a vote on this $3 trillion bill in the House. And I want to go to you first, Kate. What do you think that actually starts to look like? There's a dead on arrival bill in the House, and Powell is saying, get moving. What comes next?
Well, right. We know that that the bill that's being put forward by House Democrats, or that has been put forward, is sort of an opening bid. Senate Republicans and the White House have really called for this wait and see approach. They have different priorities. Democrats want a lot more spending to help states and cities, and they want to extend some of the sort of the aid for households, like unemployment benefits, and have more direct stimulus checks to people, and some of these, you know, Republicans might be open to other things. They've been really skeptical. But I think that, you know, officials said at the time that the CARES Act passed, or this last big bill, that it included enough aid to, you know, help the economy through roughly the next 8 weeks. So, you know, that's not a long way off. If officials are sort of waiting to figure out if they need to do more, they need to negotiate a new package. They need to vote on it. They need to start getting that money out. So I think that, the message from Powell is really don't wait, have a plan, figure out what you're going to do if the economy doesn't really bounce back as administration officials have said that they expect.
Right. And Heather, you've been writing about the state and local revenue, the budget crisis that states are facing now. And that is a part of this. You know, if it's going to come from anywhere, it's going to come from Congress. Tell us what that picture is starting to look like.
It's starting to look pretty ugly for a lot of states and municipalities, for sure. Obviously, income taxes are way down. That really impacts state budgets. Sales taxes, hotel taxes, those pesky hotel taxes, I mean, those are basically non-existent in March and April and May, and that really hurts local budgets. We're starting to see pretty big layoffs, almost a million layoffs from state and local government in April, and that's pretty unusual in this early in a crisis. So that's a big flashing red light that these places need help. The Democratic bill has $1 trillion to help state and local. You've obviously seen the president and the Treasury Secretary Mnuchin say, you know, we don't want to bail out those Democratic cities and states that weren't well managed and spend too much. But the reality is, as Senator Mitt Romney of Utah has pointed out, that it's not just Democrats who are in Democratic states that are in trouble. States like Kentucky, states like Kansas, states like Louisiana are also warning of huge budget shortfalls. They are also starting to lay off. Are they going to have to lay off teachers or police right now? That would be very bad.
Right. And then, Kate, let's make this, you know, sort of crystal clear connection. We saw this 16.4% drop in retail sales today. That translates directly to that state revenue, right? Is that a connection that needs to be a little more clear?
That's right. I mean, I guess what I would add to what Heather said is, you know, when mm-hmm. that these are, I think sometimes there's a view of, government workers are kind of different than private sector workers, but these are also people who spend money in the economy. If they're not getting paychecks, if they're not spending, that's not generating, first of all, economic activity. It's not benefiting businesses, but also that, as you said, that revenue from, for example, retail sales that that states take in, state workers make up a really large share of the workforce also. So what that means, you know, Heather said we're already starting to see it, but if this continues, these layoffs further in the year, what that means is, you know, say the economy, as businesses reopen, parts of it start to pick back up, but then right as you're seeing this upturn, states could start contracting, pulling back spending, budgets, you know, the budgets start to shrink, there's spending cuts, workers are laid off. That could really just undercut the recovery and make it, you know, longer. That's something that we saw following the last recession as well.
Heather Long is with The Washington Post. Kate Davidson is at The Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Molly.
On Wall Street today, well, Wall Street apparently still feels fine about its side of the equation. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Now, you heard us draw that bright line between retail sales and state revenues. Unfortunately for those state and municipalities, not a lot of hope there. Retail sale numbers for the month of April came out this morning. They fell by more than 16% overall from the previous month. And for clothing retail specifically, they were down by 79%. That does not exactly bode well for the clothing companies like J.Crew and Neiman Marcus that are filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy and hoping to come out the other side. Marketplace's Mariel Segura reports.
You know the kind of bankruptcy where a company sells all its stuff and closes its doors forever? That's not generally how a Chapter 11 bankruptcy is supposed to go. When a company files for Chapter 11, it's trying to come up with a plan to save the business. For a retailer, that usually means closing unprofitable stores, cutting staff, getting some debt forgiven.
So when you come out, you're a leaner and meaner company than when you went in.
Larry Katz is a business bankruptcy lawyer at Hirschler Fleischer. The thing is, if you do come out of bankruptcy leaner and meaner,
you still need to have a product that people are interested in purchasing. You still need customers, and you still need a marketing plan that makes sense.
The customer part is not looking good right now at all. Again, clothing sales down by 79%. Now, those numbers are from April, when the country was on full lockdown. So Craig Rowley at the consulting firm Korn Ferry says the drop in sales is not surprising and probably not long term.
It's hard to make any sales when your stores aren't open. The real question will be, how fast do revenues come back as stores are beginning to open up? Are consumers ready to get out? Do they feel safe? Until that's done, they aren't going to go shopping.
Also, how much has the world changed now? Randy Allen teaches management at Cornell.
Are more people going to work at home? That's going to have an impact, particularly on apparel, the kinds of apparel, who the customers are, the frequency with which people are going to buy, et cetera.
There's a lot we don't know. But she says the retailers that do succeed will have to figure out what kind of clothing people want to buy now. I'm Mariel Segura for Marketplace.
In our most recent Marketplace Edison research poll, more than 40% of respondents told us that they would have a hard time managing an unexpected expense of $250. The savings situation in this country is pretty dire. So with tens of millions of Americans out of work and even more seeing cuts in their hours and wages, many of them are tapping into their retirement accounts for basic needs. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has more.
Congress waived some of the penalties for withdrawing early from retirement accounts, and some people are going for it.
People are definitely withdrawing.
Matt Schultz is chief credit analyst at LendingTree. They recently surveyed 1,200 people with retirement savings accounts.
30% of them said that they had withdrawn funds from that account within the last couple of months, and another 20% said they would do so.
Fidelity Investments, which manages retirement accounts for 23 million people, says it's only seen about 373,000 people take a withdrawal. Megan Murphy is a senior vice president.
It represents about 1.5% of the people who we record keep retirement plans for.
She says almost 9% of people have decreased their contributions. That's almost double the number a year ago. Fidelity is a marketplace underwriter, by the way. Vanguard says its customers were withdrawing at about the same rate as last year. Whatever the exact number of people withdrawing from the retirement accounts early, David John expects it to rise. John is a senior policy advisor at AARP.
Many people have been using more liquid forms of savings to get through this month. Now they're going to start to turn to retirement accounts.
Americans weren't doing a great job saving for retirement or saving period even before coronavirus. Torsten Slok is chief economist at Deutsche Bank.
Half of the population did not have a savings account in 2019 and did not have money for a rainy day.
People who have to make withdrawals or lower contributions may leave this downturn even less prepared for retirement. LendingTree says the average withdrawal in its survey was $6,800. Over 30 years at 5% interest, that would have become $30,000. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Healthcare providers are facing a dilemma. Some are busy, even overwhelmed, caring for patients with COVID-19. But other doctors' offices, clinics, even hospital emergency rooms are close to empty. Sick people are staying away, sometimes even in serious cases, like if they're having heart attacks or strokes or have chronic conditions. Now, healthcare providers are trying to convince people to get the treatment they need. Marketplace's Erica Barris has that story.
Trisha McKenzie is a skin cancer survivor in Boston. And over the last couple months, she's had a lot of televisits with her doctors. But if her doctors asked her to come in for an exam?
I think if I was asked to go today, I probably wouldn't. I do want to go because it's for, you know, the safety of just my body. But in the same sense, I'm not sure.
A lot of patients aren't sure. At Pittsburgh pediatrician Todd Woolen's clinic, they're not seeing as many sick kids. When he gets calls from parents, he finds himself trying to reassure them.
We check you in at the front door. We escort you directly back to a room, that we have rooms for kids that are well and rooms for kids with symptoms.
But even with reassurances, people across the country are putting off routine care. Childhood vaccination rates are down, and emergency departments are seeing about half the volume they typically see. Marianne Udall Phillips, a health policy researcher at the University of Michigan, says people are afraid.
There is a lot of fear that when people go to the hospital that they will become exposed to COVID-19, and they may actually end up sicker than they would if they just stayed home.
That's led to at least 1.4 million job losses in healthcare. According to Michelle Hood with the American Hospital Association, all of those procedures that people are postponing or avoiding
oftentimes are what allows hospitals to balance their books.
So hospitals and healthcare systems have launched ad campaigns to convince people it's okay to come in. Local hospitals in Boston are telling patients that if they have chest pain or cut themselves with a kitchen knife.
Despite this pandemic,
we assure you, hospitals are doing everything possible to keep emergency departments clean and safe.
And the Kentucky Hospital Association is running this ad.
Coronavirus has changed a lot about our daily lives, but the healthcare you need doesn't have to be put on hold.
Hospitals are hoping the ads work. According to the American Hospital Association, the dip in visits is causing $50 billion a month in losses. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Coming up,
there's just not a whole lot of authoritative information for the platforms to be amplifying.
And that's where the misinformation can worm its way in. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average eked out 60 whole points, 0.2% to close at 23,685. That was still up, though. The NASDAQ advanced 70 points, 0.7% to finish at 9014. The S&P 500 added 11 points, 0.3% to end at 2863. For the week, though, the Dow lost 2.7%. The NASDAQ shaved off up 1.2%, and the S&P 500 fell 2.3%. On a day with those awful retail sales figures that Mariel Segarra told you about, JCPenney was actually up 21%, mainly because it said it made an interest payment of $17 million. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 0.64%. You are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Misinformation has a way of spreading far and wide, and make no mistake, that's not an accident. You may have heard about the recent Plandemic video, or maybe had it sent to you by a friend. It's a 26-minute video of a discredited scientist attacking people like Dr. Anthony Fauci for using the coronavirus pandemic for political gain and saying that wearing a mask could actually cause COVID-19. Just in case you need reminding, neither of those things are true. People who study disinformation campaigns, though, were not too surprised when the video went viral. They've seen the tactics before, and they know those tactics can be especially effective in times like this, times of fear and uncertainty. Renee DiResta is the technical research manager at the Stanford Internet Observatory. She studies discourse online. Renee, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Molly.
So when we see a big viral piece of misinformation like we did recently, you have argued that this is essentially a coordinated effort to push some of this information into the limelight. Tell me about how that works. How coordinated are these campaigns?
Well, in the most recent viral misleading video that went up on Facebook, you know, there was a strong marketing component to it because one of the people involved had a book to sell. So what you see is the same text will be used, you know, it'll be kind of a particular core message produced almost the way that you would see from a PR team, where the message goes out alongside the link. And there's a real attempt to get it all out at right around the same time in hopes that you can kind of trick one of the algorithms that amplifies popular content on platforms into thinking that it's seeing something that's organic and a simultaneous outpouring of organic interest in a person or topic.
What role do other influencers play in getting this into the mainstream? Like, is part of the campaign to have a list of sort of ideal influencers that you would love to get to retweet your content?
Yes, absolutely. If you get it to a sufficient number of blue check accounts that have 1 million, 2 million followers or audience members, you've really ensured that you're reaching an existing mass audience. Implied validation of a trusted influencer with a large audience really does a lot to both reach people and also create an environment in which the information is coming from someone that you trust.
Got it. Let's say the content gets taken down, in which case the conspiracy theorist becomes a digital martyr. Like, is one of the goals actually to be taken down so that then you can claim that you were censored?
Well, what we saw in the prior takedowns of this video that achieved mass appeal was actually the third video in which they declare exactly what you've said, that someone somewhere is trying to keep people from knowing the truth. That's why in some cases, the better response is rather than doing the takedown, just ensuring that the accurate information is attached as quickly as possible.
What are the opportunities in this time exactly? Because, you know, obviously there have been a lot of conversations about misinformation, about manipulating platforms. Platforms have tried to take a hands-off approach, and they're now essentially saying, you know, the virus is a clear and present public health danger. We can act more aggressively because the benefits are indisputable from a health perspective. Does that give us an opportunity for research or lasting change or data or really understanding misinformation better?
Yeah. Well, some of the work that we're doing at Stanford actually looks at the initial application of those policies. So the coronavirus misinformation policy is an extension of policies that were put in place in 2019 related to the measles outbreaks. The challenge, the interesting thing that we've seen come out of this is that the policies were designed to amplify the CDC and the World Health Organization and their information. But during the coronavirus, there was the additional challenge of health institutions trying to figure out what was going on at the same time as everybody else. Mm-hmm. And so there wasn't always great information to be amplifying because with something like hydroxychloroquine and whether it works, a scientific authority isn't going to come out with a strong, firm judgment on that prior to the research being done. And so there's this gap where people really want information, but the science isn't there yet. And so what fills the void is whatever any random person, you know, with a sufficiently large audience produces about hydroxychloroquine. So this has been an interesting time with just understanding how, you know, how do you get information to the public when there's no information?
Renee DiResta is the technical research manager at the Stanford Internet Observatory. Thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you for chatting.
For more good information about COVID-19 and what's happening around us these days, we just launched a new 10-minute daily Make Me Smart podcast with Kai Rizdahl and me, where we try to make today make sense. Subscribe to the Make Me Smart podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. We've been looking to China periodically for a look at what our post-pandemic future might be like. Almost all parts of that country are out of an economic lockdown, and in theory, people can travel freely, at least within the country. But without a vaccine, there are still many measures in place to help stop the spread of the coronavirus. More now from our China correspondent, Jennifer Pak.
Shanghai is a concrete jungle, so my vacation escape is the lush greenery in southwestern China's Yunnan province, 1,600 miles away. What should have been a 3.5-hour flight took more than half a day. So here are some tips for traveling in a COVID-19 world. Tip number one, book more time off. It'll take longer to reach your vacation spot. Flights in and out of my destination city of Dali were cut by more than half. The fastest route? Fly from Shanghai to the provincial capital of Kunming, hop on a high-speed train to Dali, take a Didi, which is like the Uber or Lyft of China. 12 hours later, arrive at the ancient village of Shuanglang. Travel tip number two. Don't expect much social distancing. There was not one empty seat on this plane from Shanghai to Kunming. Even when space isn't confined, like at Mount Tangshan UNESCO Geopark, tourists waiting to get in stand shoulder to shoulder. Travel tip number three, forget data privacy. When I land in Kunming, an announcement orders me to scan a QR code, enter my travel history. Once I get a green QR code, I can exit the airport. But a green QR code is not enough to get into the train station. At one point, three men in hazmat suits from the police, health bureau, and railway authority hover over my passport to take photos. Then they send them on WeChat to, well, I don't know who. Anyways, there is zero end-to-end encryption on this app. Travel tip number four. Don't get sweaty or you won't pass fever checks. I nearly didn't get a foot massage because I ran from the rail station to the spa. My temperature measured 100 degrees, which the authorities say indicates a fever, a symptom of the coronavirus. But the staff tell me, sit and wait until my temperature drops within normal range. Luckily, they were desperate for my business. Travel tip number five. Policies and enforcement will not be consistent, like at the entrance of Shuanglang Village. A security guard tells me to scan a different QR code from the one at the airport to check in. But he doesn't check other tourists. It's even more confusing for businesses. Officials say they want people to travel and spend, but when I stay at this boutique hotel in Sizhou, a restored heritage site, the usual crowds are gone, in part because some schools in China prevent families from traveling. There is a fear of a second wave of infections, says the hotel's co-owner, Brian Linden, a Chicago native.
I'm willing to accept the capriciousness of some of the policies, mainly because I believe they're not being made for financial somebody's pocket. I think they're being made for the best interests of the country.
Plus, he says if someone in the tourist area catches the coronavirus, his business might have to close again. 13 QR code scans, 8 registrations in person, and more than half a dozen fever checks later, I can finally enjoy my vacation. In Yunnan Province, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out. If China is one vision of a post-pandemic future, here's another. Restaurants that do reopen will need social distancing in place. And as a result, they might feel kind of empty. In Thailand, one restaurant is seating stuffed pandas at tables so diners won't feel so alone. And at the Inn at Little Washington, a 3-Michelin-star restaurant outside of Washington, D.C., they've seated mannequins in fancy 1940s clothing at empty tables. I mean, I'm sure that restaurant is really good, but I choose pandas. Mannequins are creepy. All right, we gotta go. It was a squeaker, but the markets ended up. The Dow Jones Industrial Average eked out 60 points. The NASDAQ advanced 70 points. That was 0.7%. The S&P 500 added 11 points, 0.3% there. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fregali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. And I'm Molly Wood. We'll see you back here Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.